We'd like to get started now. So if everyone could please come in and have a seat, and make sure we have all the panelists up front. Well, thank you all for coming today. My name is Scott Walston. I'm a senior fellow and director of communication policy studies at the Progress and Freedom Foundation. At PFF, we aim to promote substantive, nonpartisan, dispassionate discussion and research on important telecom policy issues. As part of that, we have an active seminar series, which includes today's event. A few weeks ago, my colleague, Tom Leonard, organized a congressional seminar on more general spectrum issues. Following that, we co-hosted with the Center for European Policy Studies a day-long broadband event in Brussels, which had panels on investment in next-generation infrastructure, net neutrality, and content development. Last week, we had an event on the prospect of reverse auctions and universal service reforms. PFF also sponsors sort of more explicitly educational events. One, our Institute for Regulatory Law and Economics, together with the University of Colorado at Boulder and George Mason University, is an intense two-day series of lectures and classes on law and economics for congressional and state regulatory staff. No lobbyists or industry representatives are allowed at those events. Attendees spend almost every waking hour either in class or reading. And as I said last week, we're proud to say that in the history of this program, nobody has ever had any fun. And yet, staff from both political parties report that it was, it was one of the most informative and useful events that they participated. Today, of course, we focus on public safety communications. The tragic events of 9/11 and Hurricane Katrina highlighted the problems that first responders and other public safety officials have communicating with each other. In many cities, it's common to see police and fire officials carry very large, outdated, and expensive walkie-talkie-type devices plus a cell phone, and you can imagine which one works better. This isn't their fault, of course, but it's the legacy of an inefficient set of communications policies. Many proposals aim to fix these problems, ranging from more money and more spectrum to private firms or public-private entities that would provide some type of nationwide service, to name a few. And meanwhile, some cities have undertaken their own initiatives to build next-generation public safety networks. I think we'll hear something about all of these plans. I'm honored to be hosting this panel today, which represents a wide range of viewpoints. I'm looking forward to a vigorous discussion, but because we have so many speakers, I'm going to be really strict about timing. Each panelist gets 10 minutes, and I will flash a 3-minute card when they have 3 minutes. Everybody see the 3-minute card? A 1-minute card when they have 1 minute, and then a stop sign when it's time to stop, and then I'm really just going to throw a fit and maybe anything else I have to throw at them to get them to stop. And I'd like the audience to hold all questions and applause until after the final speakers to ensure that we have time for Q&A. I'll introduce each speaker one at a time. We're going to go in alphabetical order. I could spend 15 minutes introducing each speaker. It's a very distinguished group. But I'm just going to say just a line or two about each one, and it's not intended as a slight. It's just a time saver. So I encourage you, please read the bios, because it's really an impressive group. So we will get started now. Our first speaker will be Michael Calabrese, who is vice president of the New America Foundation, where he directs the Spectrum Policy Program, in addition to many other initiatives. Michael.
Okay, Scott, that was brief, and I guess I have the disadvantage of sitting within reach of your elbow, so I'll watch out for your cards. The inadequacy of our communication system for first responders is really, I believe, not fundamentally a spectrum problem, but a much broader policy failure, of which spectrum is perhaps the least important part. Current public safety orthodoxy, that the big thing we really need is $10 billion more free spectrum, rests on assumptions that are almost completely the opposite of the policy we need in a digital wireless broadband world. The current U.S. system is based on four counterproductive assumptions. First, that public safety should not share spectrum or share network infrastructure, but that public safety needs exclusive spectrum and proprietary equipment. Second, that commercial networks and municipal Wi-Fi networks have little role to play. Third, that thousands of local agencies and jurisdictions should each have maximum control and flexibility rather than impose regional or national standardization and coordination. And fourth, that narrowband voice applications should dominate and operate apart from broadband networks, which one very senior public safety official told me last year will be useful add-ons someday, but are not mission critical. These assumptions need to be completely reversed if we want to modernize public safety communications in a way that is both fiscally and spectrally most efficient. Fundamental reform, and not just a better spectrum auction, is what's needed. The most important reform would push public safety to share spectrum and multipurpose broadband networks with both commercial and public Wi-Fi networks. The government is tripling the exclusive spectrum allocated to public safety. This is more than enough. Although public safety systems must be designed for peak demand, actual demand is typically orders of magnitude below peak. Therefore, sharing with priority access in emergencies would be spectrally efficient and allow public safety to share infrastructure financed through other budgets, both commercial and municipal. Of course, the competing proposals debated that will be debated here today, I didn't know I was leading off, all center around either auctions or grants of licensed spectrum for sharing commercial network capacity with public safety. That's a positive move. Okay, we like that trend. But lost in this debate is the reality on the ground. Spectrum and infrastructure sharing is not limited to a hypothetical commercially operated network to be deployed in a 700 band somewhere between 2009 and 10 years from now. Right now, today, in dozens of cities and counties, there are interoperable, high-speed, public safety wireless data networks covering entire cities, entire counties, and multi-county areas. They efficiently share infrastructure with multi-purpose wireless networks built on shared, unlicensed airwaves, which won't, by the way, set taxpayers back by billions. Corpus Christi is an operating example of a multi-purpose municipal Wi-Fi network. So I want to, just talk a bit about that. Corpus Christi is in Texas, a city of 300,000, the fifth largest port by tonnage. It has now fully operational, as of December, 150 square mile ubiquitous Wi-Fi mesh network. It's multi-purpose, not just public safety, which helps amortize the cost. The network for public safety has completely replaced the city's 800 megahertz public safety voice system. All police, fire, and EMS vehicles are equipped with mobile data computers. What does this do? It provides, for example, wireless field reporting, which keeps cops on the streets more hours every shift. In San Mateo, California, experienced so far 1.5 hours a day more time on the street. In-car two-way video streaming between incident and command centers, as well as the ability to get video over the Internet from in-building security cameras at banks and other places. Field access to mugshots, DMV, FBI, sex offender, and other databases, vehicle-to-vehicle data transfer. In addition, it provides emergency notification. As incidents unfold, a wide variety of first responders and experts from public safety to medical at all levels of government and in the private sector can be notified and kept updated simultaneously over any IP-enabled device. Mobile emergency operations centers can be set up rapidly on the spot to increase capacity. Aerial video surveillance. For incident control, Corpus Christi has a Wi-Fi-controlled unmanned 5-foot helicopter drone that broadcasts real-time aerial views of entire incident scenes. Bomb robot video surveillance, okay, streaming video feed viewable at command or from any police vehicle. Automated vehicle and asset tracking. GPS over Wi-Fi tracks all public safety vehicles and can even track firefighters within buildings. With all those applications running over your unlicensed multipurpose network, it certainly doesn't take 50 megahertz of spectrum to secure other mission-critical communications that you might have. So these shared networks can take most of the bandwidth, and, you know, even if some certain band is kept proprietary. Multipurpose networks also pay for themselves. through automated meter reading, expedited field inspections and building permits, video monitoring of crime areas, portable cameras like in New Orleans that they move around. And not incidentally, these networks can also offer low-cost, ubiquitous broadband service for citizens. Other cities with functioning state-of-the-art public safety broadband over unlicensed include, as I mentioned, San Mateo, Pratt, Kansas, Moro and Umatilla counties in Oregon, Las Vegas, New Orleans, Spokane. There are more than 100 in construction or planning. So what's needed, actually, is more and better unlicensed spectrum so that these networks, you know, will get a rocket boost. And right now, the unused TV channels in each local market, which the FCC is considering for unlicensed and which legislation is on the Hill to that regard, is really the rocket fuel that will provide these multipurpose public safety city and county networks with what they need. Finally, on the more immediate and narrow issue of the reallocation of the 700 band spectrum from TV to public safety, I'll just, I guess, risk jumping out a little bit ahead before we've even heard, for example, about the frontline proposal, just to say that, you know, that we tend to think that of the various options that are out there, the four kind of leading proposals, that this one seems to strike the best balance between creating incentives for commercial build-out of a shared network on the one hand, and on the other hand, protecting both public safety and efficient use of the airwaves. The other three leading proposals are fatally flawed for some very different reasons. First, the Siren Call and McCain proposals would needlessly take 30 megahertz of prime spectrum away from commercial broadband, harming consumers and American competitiveness in the process. The Siren Call proposal is premised on a $5 to $10 billion windfall. The McCain variation on Siren Call, although premised on an auction, which is good, would turn critical public safety systems over to an unregulated monopoly with inherent conflicts of interest. At the other extreme, and I'm wrapping up here, at the other extreme, the FCC proposal does not go far enough. At 12 megahertz, a broadband network is unlikely to create a sufficient commercial incentive for national build-out. So as you'll hear, I think, from Janice, frontline, not to say it's perfect, but I think it's at least smack in the middle of these two, retaining all 60 megahertz for auction, but conditioning the license on a 10 megahertz piece adjacent to public safety. Indeed, what we find most, another facet that's very interesting about this proposal is that it would also open the network on a wholesale basis to any other ISP or innovator on a non-discriminatory basis. So in that sense, it shares the virtue of these multipurpose muni and county public networks that serve both public safety and the broader public. So compared to other options, I guess I just put a stake in the ground that I think it's superior as spectrum, fiscal, communications, and innovation policy.
Thanks very much, Michael. Before we move on, could I ask one of my PFF colleagues to come and be a timekeeper, perhaps, to hold the cards? It's hard to hold them sideways if some just decide somebody to come. Our next speaker is Jeff. Well, we'll see. If you're going to be good, then you don't mind an enforcement mechanism.
I can set my alarm.
So Jeff Eisenach co-founded the Progress and Freedom Foundation in 1993 and served as its president for a decade. He's currently the chairman of Criterion Economics and co-author of a recent paper on this issue. Jeff, please.
Scott, thank you. It's an honor to be here. It's always an honor to have an opportunity to speak at the Progress and Freedom Foundation. I continue to serve on the board of directors here, and I'm very proud of the work that it continues to do after my departure several years ago as president. Word of disclosure, I'm not here on behalf of PFF. I'm here as chairman of Criterion Economics, and we were recently asked to prepare a paper on looking primarily at the Siren Call proposal.
And we were asked to do that by the High Tech DTV Coalition and the Consumer Electronics Association. So full disclosure, we wrote a paper and we got paid to write the paper. But it's worth just saying for a second, why would those two groups be so concerned about the siren call proposal? The answer to that question, I think, is very simple. We have been working in the U.S. for an ungodly long time to produce an extremely difficult result. I think really one of the most complex pieces of sausage making that I've seen go on in the Hill in a long time, and that was the effort to finally put in place the mechanism for transitioning broadcasters off of their analog spectrum and into digital broadcasting. That exercise went on for many, many years. It wasn't until just about 11 months ago, I guess, 13 months ago, that Congress finally passed legislation setting a date certain for that transition to take place. There were lots of competing and, I think, legitimately competing interests involved in bringing that legislation to fruition. Obviously, the broadcasters have an interest. Everybody who watches television and has an analog television set has an interest. Because of the value of the spectrum that's being freed up, taxpayers have an interest in deficit reduction. And because of the potential to use that spectrum for other purposes, CMRS providers, cell phone companies, and others who might bid on the spectrum have an interest. Because of the fact that public safety spectrum is involved, does the public safety community, getting all of those parties, and I'm sure I haven't named all of them exhaustively, together to support a piece of legislation and have that legislation pass with a schedule for an auction, with the allocation of the funding to deficit reduction, to interoperability for public safety, to a program to assist low-income people with purchasing converters for their analog television sets, to bring all of that to fruition, get it in place, finally set a date certain, and then 4 months later to have somebody show up and say, oh, I got a different idea. I think, sent chills down a lot of spines. At the outset, I think it is simply naive to suggest that you can, that the various pieces of that legislation are separable. And I think anybody who's ever been involved in the drafting process, anybody who's sat anywhere close to any of the rooms in which the DTV transition was negotiated, has to know that if you take one piece out of that puzzle, one card out of that house, that the house comes tumbling down. And I think that is what, for the literally tens of thousands of people now who are working every day to make the DTV transition happen, I think the prospect that we would see legislation that would undo that very difficult bargain is frightening. So I would start by saying that. I find myself in surprising agreement with Michael. We don't always agree on things, I think, or sometimes don't always agree on things. I find myself in agreement with, I think, the sentiments and the overall sentiments that he expressed. This, having had the opportunity now to give a number of talks on this issue, to look at the issue through this paper, and to do it, kind of stepping back as somebody who spent time at the Office of Management and Budget and who spent a lot of time thinking about government programs and how they work or don't work, this is clearly an example of an utter failure, I think, on all fronts of at federal level and of government generally to solve a problem that is not new, has been around for a long time, and clearly needs a solution. We clearly don't have the kind of interoperable public safety communication systems today that public safety agencies need, nor do we have the broadband capabilities that they ought to have. Why don't we have those things? Well, I think they're I'll turn it over now and talk about what is it that we need to do in order to be able to get them. I think there are four components to a solution. The first and the one that has been, I think, so utterly lacking, despite the best efforts of a lot of people, is coordination. We have literally tens of thousands of public safety agencies around the country. Those aggregate up to the state level. We have state agencies, and then we have literally hundreds of federal agencies, all involved as users of the spectrum. And then we have a multitude of entities that are that each have a piece of the policy pie, most notably today the Department of Homeland Security, the FCC, and NTIA, but many others. Again, I think they've tried hard. The National Coordinating Committee, the Public Safety Wireless Advisory Committee back in the 1990s, there have been efforts, certainly, to bring these agencies together. I noticed the FCC has got a spectrum summit now for public safety scheduled in April. So there have been a lot of efforts to do this, but the simple fact of the matter is that we do not have, to this day, we do not have an agreed-upon design for the next generation of public safety communications. What we have, I think, is a Band-Aid approach, and what we finally have in the FCC's ninth order is we have the makings of a national coordinating entity and a process that can finally give us a sensible means of building out this extremely valuable 24 megahertz of spectrum that is part of the 700 megahertz spectrum, which will if we don't go off the tracks here, which will be made available to public safety in February 2009, already is in markets where the analog spectrum isn't being used by analog broadcasters, which is a lot of markets. So that's number one. Number two, I'm going to speed up here. Number two, technology. Public safety has over-relied on specialized technology. They've done a poor job, I think, of coordinating, and I'm not pointing a finger at any particular entity here. We're talking about thousands of entities, several of whom could have stepped up and coordinated and exercised a greater leadership role. So, I think it, one of the things that is hard here is it's hard to point fingers, and maybe ultimately it comes back to Congress to say, you need to identify the responsible party here. But public safety agencies purchase too many different kinds of equipment from too many different vendors, and they don't capture economies of scale. They're simply not getting the benefit of the fact that, I can walk into a singular Verizon store and buy this for $99. They're spending $4,000 for something that is, if dropped on the floor, probably is harder, but it does not have beyond that greater capabilities. Funding is a piece of it, and I think a lot of what we're seeing in terms of the current proposals are sort of ways to cover up with smoke and mirrors the fact that Congress and the other government entities involved have not made available sufficient funding to move to the next generation network. And that's something I think everybody does need to look to. I don't think the mechanism that the Siren Call envisions is a means of doing that. I don't think you can load it onto the private sector and cross your fingers. Clearly, I think government needs to step up to the line here and make the funding available. And I don't think we have a clear sense of what that is. But it's certainly not. It's certainly more than $1 billion. And then finally, spectrum. The question is put, is 24 megahertz enough? Is 12 megahertz enough to build a broadband network within that? And at the end of the day, we ended up reaching the conclusion it is based on some things that are happening in New York, based on some things that are happening in Washington, D.C., based on studies that have been done by people like John Paya. But it is also true that there is not a defined design today for the system that would get built within the 12 megahertz or within the 24 megahertz, if you want to think of it more broadly. No one has sat down and said, we'll build this system, it'll do these things. Well, until you know what the answer to that question is and you compare that to the list of things that need to be done, how can you be sure? All right, we ended up having an opinion. I think that opinion is probably correct, but can you say with absolute certainty there is no application, there is no technology, there is no infrastructure that would ever demand more spectrum for public safety or that we would ever want to be allocating to that? The answer to that, I think, is it's hard to come to that conclusion with absolute firmity. So what do you do? As I've indicated, I won't bear down on it. How am I doing here? I'm done. I'll just say one thing, and that is I think with the siren call proposal, you have a proposal that has lots of free lunch in it, lots of smoke and mirrors in it, and a proposal that really risks sticking the taxpayer with every problem you can imagine. $10 billion in guaranteed loans that can't get paid back, encumbered spectrum that can't get repatriated, really kind of the potential for the worst of all worlds. The frontline proposal is a little different, and I do agree with Michael that there is some potential there because it really focuses in on the potential for shared use, and I think that is something that really is worth exploring, and they've put some interesting ideas on the table. I will say the thing, and this won't surprise anybody, the thing I like least about the frontline proposal is what Michael likes best about it, and that is these industrial policy aspects of it, where we're going to come in and say to the successful bidder for the spectrum, not only do you have to fulfill a public safety obligation, but in addition, we're going to write your business model for you. You've got to be wholesale, and you got to provide roaming, and it's got to be at regulated rates and so forth. It seems to me that that is an aspect that does not need to be brought into this debate. If we're going to impose some encumbrances on that spectrum, it ought to be focused on public safety, not on industrial policy and kind of a social agenda, which really doesn't have any place in this debate. So I'm a minute over.
All right. Thanks very much, Jeff. I should just add that we did invite Siren Call to participate, but they did not want to, despite our many requests. So our next speaker is the Honorable Mike Gallagher, who is an adjunct fellow with PFF and a partner with Perkins Coie. He was previously an Assistant Secretary of Commerce and for Communications and Administrator of NTIA. Mike.
Well, thanks for the introduction. It's great to be here with PFF. Like Jeff, I share great affection for the organization and the value it's contributed over the time that I've certainly been engaged in communications policy issues. It's also great to be here with this panel. It's a wonderful group of very smart people. You may hear some disagreement as we go through, but there's certainly a amount of everyone's entitled to a high degree of respect for what they've accomplished. Larry Irving and I co-wrote a paper which has been put out on the table focused on how we can achieve interoperability, we believe, the quickest with the least amount of risk. And we'll talk about legislative risk in a second. But Larry and I left government. We got together, and it just seemed that this was something that we both had a fair amount of energy. And for those of you who know Larry, Larry and I both together with a microphone, it's interesting. But we talked about it a little bit in the sense of it seemed to be an issue that was coming to the forefront in Congress. There certainly are solutions at hand. We'll talk about those in a second. But also that, we had Hurricane Katrina September 11th, and he says, well, hey, Mike, listen, it started well before then. He says, I can tell you about Waco. I can tell you about the first attacks on the Twin Towers in New York. So for him, it's a matter of a great degree of passion, and we share that together. And we put together this paper. It's very readable with a 6-point plan on how to get at the solution as soon as possible, make the biggest amount of progress as fast as possible. We accept the need. In fact, describe it in the same detail as you'll find a number of other places, advocates for improvement, except very much the vision of what we should be striving to deploy for public safety because we enjoy much of those things as consumers today. What we differ is on tactics. The first thing we need to do, and it must happen, is we have to complete the digital transition and hold the auction as soon as possible. We need to, and the reason why is twofold. It puts the spectrum in the hands of public safety, the 24 megahertz. It also ensures the spending of the $1 billion at least that the Department of Commerce has to allocate to public safety interoperability networks that is now the subject of the MOU with DHS. That money comes from the auction proceeds. Without the auction, this whole progress, the deadline that we're facing for a triggering event goes by the wayside. Second, there was a number of pieces of very significant progress that were achieved last year that received no attention legislatively. One of them is the passage of the DHS Approach Act, which it told Secretary Chertoff, you must appoint a director of interoperability, and there must be a plan published this year for how we're going to get there. So DHS is charged with actually publishing the plan on how we're going to achieve interoperability, so there's clear legislative direction there. The third prong is that state and local governments and public safety community must look beyond their own jurisdictional borders, must look beyond their particular silo or agency for how communications have to be adopted going forward. The numbers of public safety entities vary between 34,000 and 60,000, depending on who you talk to. The whole point is that the new networks must be regional, digital, interoperable networks. They can no longer be so dependent, certainly they shouldn't be analog, but we have to be moving into an environment where these are shared architectures, where like today, I can hook up my computer to a cable modem or to the modem that's in my home with my Fios network or to a wireless network, and it just happens. That's the same type of connectivity that should exist in the public safety arena. Fourth prong is that the FCC should make sure that not one hertz of the 24 megahertz of spectrum, not one hertz, goes to yesterday's systems. We must stop making the problem worse by enabling more of the older technologies. That spectrum should be reserved for 21st century networks only. And those technologies do exist. Well, we've heard a couple of examples from Michael in the unlicensed space, but Coco Communications has a network that's up and running at Dallas Love Field, which integrates communications not only amongst federal, state, and local officials, but also the private sector at the airport. So these the solutions are available, and we should require that those are what's used in the 24 megahertz. The fifth prong is let's integrate some of these ideas. As the we passed the WARN Act last year, the WARN Act provides for emergency alerts. And with the technologies that the wireless carriers have today, if we work in cooperation with them, we'll be able to deploy the ability of public safety to send targeted alerts to affected communities. That is a very powerful improvement to our system that doesn't exist today. It's putting these pieces together that's going to create the public safety interoperability environment that we would like to see. And finally, the sixth prong is all new money goes to new technologies and new systems. We can no longer afford to put rare funding, scarce funding behind networks that are analog or non-interoperable with other networks. It should only go towards new systems. That will help the public safety community come into alignment behind standards and deployment of those networks. I would also say that since Larry and I wrote that paper in November, we've had a number of very positive steps forward where we're making significant progress. The first one is that the FCC published its NPRM and is looking at making sure we have modern rules for modern networks in the 24 megahertz. That is very encouraging. You see, the commission's approach is to focus on 12 megahertz. My view is that we should not waste a single hertz on any systems that don't meet tomorrow's demands. The House passed its E911 Commission recommendations package, which again had funding dedicated to this purpose. NTIA has moved forward in issuing its MOU with the Department of Homeland Security on freeing up and spending the $1 billion that will be coming forward to help be a catalyst for development and deployment of these new networks. Also, we see that Secretary Chertoff has been very vocal about the need, and that the time is now for solving this problem. A couple of examples. One is the DHS published its status report and graded various localities around the country on their efforts towards interoperability. That was done at the secretarial level, not to dismiss the importance of assistant secretaries, but it was done at the very top. It's receiving a very significant attention and focus, and he also indicated several times in testimony that $5 billion of funding is coming online or is in the pipeline. That's a very significant amount of money that should lead to real deployments. Not PowerPoint, not meetings, but real deployments of interoperable networks using technologies that are forward-looking. Finally, the FCC convened the advisory group it was called to under the WARN Act, and that group, by all measurements, is running ahead of schedule. And the carrier input to the emergency alert process seems to be progressing very positively. These are the confluence of events. We have the technology, we have the spectrum, we have the money. What's necessary is the coordination, leadership, and execution to get this job done. I would also say that a couple other things, just on the risk of legislating in this space. I want to echo what was said about the delicacy of the compromise that led to the DTV Transition Act that we have to take advantage of today. I was here in 1996 when we did the Telecom Act, and remember vividly how controversial the provisions were of putting any transition date in at all. And then the triggering event for that, and then the improvements we made in two subsequent pieces of legislation. If we reopen that battle, or reopen that balance, there are so many different aspects that could be renegotiated. The 24 megahertz itself would be in jeopardy. The funding that's already dedicated, the $1 billion, would be in jeopardy. Other grant programs that also are coming out of that money, which include low-power TV upgrades, include special funds dedicated to 911 recovery in September 11th recovery systems in New York, and emergency alert systems, all of those things are also funded out of this auction. Those equities are also put at risk by moving forward in legislation in that space. We also we chill the progress that's being made today. I think all of us have been exposed to the tremendous efforts that CEA and NAB and MSTV are making to make this transition successful. Very aggressive notice campaigns. If that date's in question, if there's serious discussion about legislation here, that only chills the interest on people executing what they need to do to successfully move us through the transition. So for all of those reasons, I really think the legislative risk is so great. We must focus on what we have today. We have the tools. We should get the job done.
Thanks, Mike. Our next speaker is Stephen Jones, who's the executive director of the First Response Coalition, which is a nonprofit organization promoting the emergency communications and data information preparedness needs of America's first responders.
Thank you. Hi, good afternoon to everybody. My name is Stephen Jones. I am the executive director of the First Response Coalition. And first and foremost, I would like to thank the Progress and Freedom Foundation for inviting me here today and for hosting this important and timely event. This country has, for far too long, neglected critical shortcomings in first responder communications. I applaud the foundation for convening this panel so we can better understand the challenges, discuss potential solutions, and work together towards resolution of the communications crisis. For those of you who aren't familiar with the First Response Coalition, I would like to take just a minute or two to tell you a little bit about who we are. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization promoting the needs of America's first responders in the areas of emergency communications interoperability and data and information preparedness. Obviously, as recent national tragedies have revealed, first responder communications are too often incompatible or they're not interoperable. And as a result, first responders are unable to effectively communicate with one another in an emergency. That puts the lives of not only first responders at risk, but also the lives of the very communities that they aim to protect at risk as well. Not only do first responders need to be able to effectively communicate with one another, they also need access to the advanced technologies that provide potentially life-saving information. And we've already talked a little bit about that, but I just will expand on it for just a second here. I mean, consider for just one moment the amount of information that you, the average person, have access to. You can remotely access your email from just about any location, connect to the internet and download music, images, ringtones, find the nearest movie theater, the show times, and even purchase those tickets online, all from the palm of your hand. With the click of a button, you literally have access to a universe of information. If only first responders had that luxury to acquire the information they need and when they need it. In public safety world, first responders are too often unable to access critical information which could help them do their jobs more effectively. And it's already been alluded to the case of Corpus Christi, Texas. 3D images, streaming videos, access to remote cameras, incident video, doing criminal records in the fields, mugshots in the fields. All these capabilities inform an emergency response and have the potential to help first responders do their jobs more safely and more effectively. The FRC is working diligently to get technologies like these into the hands of first responders and emergency managers so they can better protect our communities. The FRC consists of tens of thousands of concerned citizens, first responders, and emergency managers, and also public safety dispatchers, to name just a few. In addition, the FRC is supported by a number of emergency response and public health organizations such as the National Association of Hispanic Firefighters, National Black Police Association, the Association of Emergency Physicians, the American Public Health Association. And the First Response Coalition is also supported by a number of citizen advocacy groups, including the League of United Latin American Citizens, or LULAC, and the National Black Chamber of Commerce. So why such a diverse coalition? Well, simply put, first responder issues, at the end of the day, are very much community issues. And these organizations and others have joined the FRC because they understand that when we protect first responders, we protect ourselves. Last year, do you mind? Okay, thank you. Last year, I'll drink that one too. Last year, at about this time, the First Response Coalition wrote a letter to the president urging him to make resolution of the communications crisis a national priority. Much like President Kennedy did in 1961, when he committed this nation to landing a man on the moon within 10 years, we urge the president to make a similar commitment to resolve the communications crisis. The FRC argued, and still believes, that a declarative statement to achieve interoperability by date certain, coupled with meaningful action and national leadership, will help to align the many well-intended but disparate and often competing programs so that they can work together towards a common solution. As an initial step, we urge the President to convene a national interoperability summit, which would bring together first responders, policymakers, academics, industry, and other stakeholders who would decide upon a target date by which to achieve interoperability within the next 10 years. I'm sorry to report that the President has not replied to my letter. However, I was happy to see that the FCC on April 20th will be hosting a national or a first responder communications summit to focus on government agencies and public safety initiatives, the transition from legacy to future architectures, and broadband applications for first responders. I was also encouraged when Congress last year passed the FY07 DHS Appropriations Act and included in it language from Congressman Reichert's 21st Century Emergency Communications Act. The Act establishes an Office of Emergency Communications and directs the new office to, among other things, develop a national emergency communications plan for effective first responder communications during disasters, and also establish a time frame for deploying nationwide emergency communications systems. So while the Act actually falls short of calling for a date certain by which to achieve interoperability, I think when one considers the transition to DTV and the release of 24 megahertz of spectrum to first responders, the upcoming FCC summit, and the establishment of the Office of Emergency Communications at DHS, it's clear that the Congress has provided a solid foundation upon which to build. And this fact is actually borne out by what is occurring in the states. In the absence of a national cohesive strategy for achieving interoperability, more and more states are taking the lead on interoperability by maximizing available spectrum and connecting stakeholders through unique and effective governance systems. The FRC's new report, which is several copies are located on the table there outside the doors. If not, it's also available on our homepage. Looked at interoperability efforts in several states and arrived at the following conclusions. One, funding remains the major hurdle to achieving full interoperability. Two, first responder communication systems are being created and upgraded with new technologies without large spectrum allocations. And three, there is a distinct need for adherence to technical standards to better ensure equipment deployed across jurisdictions is compatible. The Department of Homeland Security has accurately characterized the interoperability issue as one that contains both human and technological elements. Issues of incompatible and aging communications equipment, limited and fragmented funding and budget cycles, planning and coordination radio spectrum, and also limited standards. The conclusions reached in the FRC's new report support the five major challenges identified by DHS. But it's critical to point out that satisfying just one of these conditions doesn't get you to interoperability. Although first responders need more spectrum than what they currently have, simply providing more spectrum won't solve the issue. Neither will simply throwing more money at the problem, though certainly federal funding is critical for first responders as well. So it's an interesting, multifaceted, evolving policy issue, and one that affects everyone sitting in this room. I'm looking forward to the discussion, and thanks again for having me here today.
Thanks very much. Our next speaker is Janice Sobuchowski, who is founder and president of Freedom Technologies and chairman of Frontline Wireless. And as a moderator, I try to take no opinions on position on anything, but I thought it was worth repeating a cartoon that was in RCR News. I'm sure you know what I'm referring to. In the first panel, there's just a figure that represents the FCC saying, here's a plan that looks to be efficient, transparent, and effective. They want their spectrum in an auction, and they're not asking for any giveaways. And the next frame, the figure says, so what the hell are they up to? And so now perhaps Janice will answer that question.
I think I need to give that cartoonist at RCR a real vote of appreciation. And I also would like to begin by thanking PFF for giving us the floor here. Since Frontline is a new company, please excuse me for taking a minute of my time not addressing the largest issues on the table that my fellow panelists have already covered, I think, you know, quite comprehensively, but by talking a little bit about our company. We are proud to say that our CEO is Mr. Haynes Griffin, who built Vanguard Cellular into one of the largest independent cellular companies in the country before he sold that company to AT&T in 1999. And then the two other senior-most officers of the company are Reed Hunt and myself. Now, since we are here on Capitol Hill, it probably comes as no surprise to you that one of us would come from one side of the aisle and the other from the other. But when we sat down to talk about this vision, there were enormous points of commonality. A commitment to competition and auctions, a commitment to modern technology, a commitment to solving problems, a commitment and a belief that using advanced technology, some of this debate can, in essence, be mooted. Indeed, we agree on all aspects of the plan that we've put forward. We're confident in it. We have given each other mutual proxies in all matters other than political campaign contributions. So our official launch was through the submission of comments in the 9th NPRM, which I think the other panelists have covered in terms of content. We certainly applaud the FCC in that it is moving this ball quickly towards auctions and that it embraced a concept that I will credit Morgan O'Brien and Siren Call with, which is the notion of a shared broadband network. I don't think we can take anything away from that contribution to this debate. And the fact that a year after that plan was proposed roughly, I think there's commonality of vision that is the way forward, is a tribute to the vision that Morgan put forward. In essence, as we looked at the 9th NPRM, there are areas that we are fully in agreement with, and a couple upon which we would like to build further. And those two areas are as to the allocation of spectrum to broadband for public safety and an open access vision. Firstly, to the subject that's really front and center today, as you know, the FCC's 9th NPRM would take the 24 megahertz that has been allocated to public safety and divide it in half and say one half would be dominant broadband usable by commercial subject to the approval of the appropriate public safety governing body. We wholly subscribe to that. What we would further propose is that the adjacent Block D be cut into 2 5 megahertz blocks, and that the E block, most closely situated to the public safety allocation, would be auctioned off to a commercial player. That player would build a network spanning both the E block and the 12 megahertz that has been dedicated under the FCC vision to public safety. On the government side of the line, the legislated public safety line, the builder of the public safety network would only have access if on terms and conditions fully approved by the public safety governing body. On the commercial side of the line, if there were an interest on the part of public safety, and this is entirely subject to their game plan, their vision, that would be preemptible on an emergency basis. In essence, I think you can debate until the cows come home about whether 12 megahertz broadband is sufficient or not, and you can put a lot of studies out there about money, about technology, about what type of catastrophe, and certainly a lot of very good things are happening regionally, locally, and indeed nationally. But the fact remains that most experts who address this topic say that, yes, day in and out, the 12 megahertz is fully adequate, but in the case of a national emergency or regional emergency, that may well not be the case. And so in those instances, the 5 megahertz blocks would be preemptable. A second aspect of our vision, less on the table, but thank you, Michael, for alluding to it, is the open access vision. And we would maintain that the e-block would be subject to rules that would enable open services, open hardware access, in essence, full-fledged roaming. You know, people can cast this in any way that might fit the debate. I certainly would not cast this as social policy. I would cast this as an outstanding economic policy, competition policy, and frankly, innovation policy. One of Haynes Griffin's sort of experiences as a business person in the Vanguard era, you know, was the increasing difficulty in a consolidated industry of attaining roaming in a absolutely predictable fashion. And so as we're looking to build out rural America, as we're looking to promote competition, this roaming opportunity is certainly an excellent way to promote competition, new entry, and rural services. Furthermore, we do not subscribe to, we do not advocate retroactive imposition of open access on people who've, you know, bought and paid for their spectrum. That's not a debate that we're going to enter. But in terms of national innovation policy, you know, we posit that that's the absolutely positive way forward. So with that said, we're only as good as our ideas are at this state of the game. We've advanced them at the FCC. We're advancing them for your consideration. Even if our ideas, which we believe are sound, are accepted, and we are we're confident that we'll obtain a good and open-minded hearing on them. Even so, in the auction, you know, we'll face the marketplace test. And we're comfortable with that. That's certainly true to the principles of the founders. I guess really I think everything else that needs to be said at this point by me has been said. I kind of want to close by posing a question that came up last night. I went to the Who concert and heard their one of their many signature songs, and that signature song is, you know, Who Are You? I don't know how you folks feel about this, but, you know, I'm tired of hearing about the failures of public safety and, you know, the contentiousness of this. I, in fact, think what the FCC has advanced, what many people in this room are advancing, is something approaching a going forward vision that we as a nation can focus on, build upon, and really be inspired to bring out the best in ourselves, using the technology that we all concede is available to build a network, a nationwide network, that public safety can use and that innovators can use on fair and equal terms. That's what Frontline is staking its case on. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our final speaker is Charles Werner, who is a 32-year veteran of the fire service and a 28-year veteran of the Charlottesville, Virginia Fire Department, and currently its fire chief. He's also deeply engaged in these policy debates, speaking, writing, and including his service on the International Association of Fire Chiefs Communications Committee. Please.
Thank you. I guess to start off, I'm going to have to say that I have a greatly differing opinion than most of the panelists that are here today. Everyone here is speaking from rhetoric and ideology, and I can tell you that I'm the one person who is here that has gone into the burning buildings, who has rescued people in situations that need to have the technology. Unfortunately, my concern is that the direction that we're heading now with the rhetoric that's in place, if it's continued to allow to occur, is it's me that's going to suffer the consequences and the people that work in my department. We currently have a policy nationwide that's called Everybody Goes Home. It's 16 initiatives, and communications is one of the biggest things a part of it. Before you all tell me and my colleagues that are here with me today and those across the nation what it is that we need, I'd like to tell you what we need. And I think that a lot of the things that you all talked about are very well-intended. And I applaud you for your intention, but you know what they say about intentions. The other thing about it is that a lot of the assumptions that have been made in these other reports today are vastly flawed. If the assumptions that you made were correct on the economics part, on the spectrum part, we would already have the national commercial wireless vendors at our feet. Unfortunately, that's not the case. And I want you to realize that when it comes to public safety, that's not just two words. That's the woods that are over here. That's me. That's the people that I work with every day to work out and provide the service to rescue you each day. And the technology that we potentially have to offer will help us do that job. And one day, I'm guessing that you'll need us to help you, to rescue you. And I'm asking you to help us so that we can do that job. I'm, as a chief, that's responsible for my firefighters. And I can tell you the whole thing about funding isn't there. The $1 billion that says is going to be a lot of money to make a difference, if you spread that out and look and see what $1 billion does and divide it by different places, it doesn't do much. We have an opportunity to change the paradigm. And that time is now. If we don't take action now, it'll be almost criminal to let this spectrum go away from us in a way that would really do something meaningful. One clear picture that all of you have missed here, and again, I think this is because you haven't talked to us, is operability. And while a lot of you say that none of the spectrum should be given to old technology, I can tell you there are departments today that need spectrum because of congestion on what they have, especially in the metropolitan cities. To put this restriction in place would tie our hands to be able to solve the problems that we need to solve today. Your ideas are great for tomorrow if it could work out. We don't have time to wait till tomorrow. I also believe that when it comes down to this whole idea of a public safety broadband trust, it puts public safety at the head of the table. It gives us a chance to regulate, decide how it's going to work up front, not an afterthought as it was to get me into this panel today. It is very important that public safety has a seat and outlines what it needs to do today before this goes into place. The paradigm shift has to occur to do a lot of the things you're talking about. If we put a public safety broadband trust in place and are able to do that, you would see a paradigm start to change, but we have to have a place to go. We have to have a place to develop the new strategies and use the new technologies as we move off of the older obsolete technology into a new area. I don't see it happening together. I don't think that's realistic. And when we look at all the things that are out there and we hear what you say, promises have been far too many and far unanswered for public safety. Since 1997, we've heard that we need spectrum. And here we don't need spectrum when in Communication Daily and TR Daily, they quote Dr. Boyd of saying he is offended to hear such statements being made. We are the public safety people that provide the service to you, and we need you to help us make a difference in moving in directions in the future. And I'd also like to challenge you to do one thing, and I'd like you to look at the people on this panel and their involvement and ask, where does the funding come from that paid for them to do what they did, or what potential interest do they have in what is in place? Now, I can tell you from my standpoint, my interest is in public safety. It's in serving you as citizens. It's serving everybody. I don't have any monetary interest in the deal. I just want to see something happen that makes a difference for public safety. And then I hear from the First Response Coalition that things are making progress and alludes to the fact that we may not need spectrum. I kind of see that as throwing the rest of us public safety guys under the bus. I am the chair of the Virginia Interoperability Executive Committee, and I can tell you while we've made progress, we need spectrum. So don't go there. It's very difficult to stand up here and fight about a constant misinformation campaign about what is or what isn't needed. But I'm here to tell you that we need to make a change. And then in the frontline scenario, while it's an interesting thought, it doesn't put public safety first. We come in later, after the fact. And then you'll have to, I'll have to apologize for a little bit of my ignorance on this, and I don't know the details, but there's also concern of Frontline's association with NextWave, which apparently had something to do with spectrum and some controversy. You'll have to look into that yourself. I don't know what it's about, but ask the questions. Again, it comes down to what are we doing, how are we trying to get there, and what do we need to do to get there together? And I thank you for the opportunity to speak today.
All right, thank you very much. We'd like to open up the floor to questions. I don't know if we have a microphone. We do? Okay, great. So when you have a question, please first state your name and affiliation if you could, because it'll make it easier when we write out the transcript from the audio recordings. Any questions? Wait 1 second.
This is Paul Kirby with Telecom Reports. Since Chief Warner mentioned the First Response Coalition and he felt that you were throwing them under the bus, as it were, the major public safety groups, the national public safety groups, feel they need more spectrum. Your coalition, which is backed by industry, feels that's not necessary. Did you want to respond, I guess, to what he just said to you?
Yeah, I would. Thank you for that question. Chief, I admire your passion, and I absolutely respect your position and the work that you and all the folks down in Charlottesville do. In fact, the work that all firefighters do, having spent several years myself in the fire service, I know that they do incredible work on an everyday basis. I want to be very clear about this. First responders need additional spectrum. I never said they didn't need additional spectrum. That additional spectrum is coming in form, the 24 megahertz, from the DTV transition. I think that is an absolutely good thing. The First Response Coalition absolutely believes that part of the discussion needs to be how can we use this spectrum more efficiently? How can we best take advantage of it to make sure that we maximize it out in the field? And so my point, again, that first, well, in fact, I didn't say this. This was a gross mischaracterization. That first responders don't need additional spectrum is patently false. They do. They will be receiving that as part of the digital TV transition, and we would like to add to the debate, to this discussion, how can we best take advantage of that spectrum.
But you're saying there's not a need for more than 24 megahertz?
There may be, but what I'm saying is that we need to also bring into the discussion how the new technologies, better coordination, how do we do this on a regional basis to take better advantage of the spectrum that's already available. You know, we look at places, like here in Washington, D.C., they are operating the WARN network in 700 megahertz spectrum. That network is going to be extended out to the entire national capital region. The simple point being that is an example of how spectrum is being used more efficiently and how it's being used with already available spectrum. It's an absolutely critical part of the discussion and one that the First Response Coalition hopes is considered during this larger debate.
Can I just ask one more question? I'll give this up.
Okay. I just wanted to ask Janice, since Chief Warner mentioned it, he mentioned NextWave. Did you want to address it, your NextWave, your previous NextWave affiliation, since you just mentioned NextWave kind of on the fly?
Sure. I'll be happy to answer the direct question. There is absolutely no corporate connection between Frontline Wireless and NextWave. The overlap has to do with the part of my career when I was a part of and founder of NextWave. I will put that forth as part of my record along with the rest of my track record as a professional in and out of government. So that's really all I need to say. Thanks.
Any other comments from the panel?
Yeah, on this, you know, on this question of more spectrum or not, I think it's very important. This is probably implicit in what I was saying, but to make it explicit, there's a distinction between more access to the airwaves and more exclusive licensed spectrum for public safety alone, right? So public safety certainly needs and is getting far more access to the airwaves, but it can do that in more spectrally and fiscally efficient ways. So, for example, as I was saying, all those things that are happening in Corpus Christi, okay, and many other towns around the country, I mean, that is almost in some ways, what they're already doing in Corpus Christi is in some ways the dream of what you would do with, whether it's 12 megahertz or 24 or 30 megahertz of spectrum, but they're doing it on unlicensed spectrum, on a multi-purpose network. And if we open all the wasted spectrum on the TV band for these municipal and county networks, we'll have tons of spectrum there. Then there's a spectrum that could be shared with commercial networks, such as, you know, and some of it could come through the auction. So Janice's proposal, Frontline's proposal, that, for example, 10 megahertz through the auction could be used as a backup for public safety during those peak demand incident periods. And then finally, I'd note, and I'm looking at, I don't want to preempt Michael, I don't know if you want to read your own.
Go ahead.
I'm holding Michael Gallagher's, he did a chart in his comments to the FCC in this proceeding, you know, which shows, for example, that currently, there could be a current problem, there's 23 megahertz available for public safety today in a licensed exclusive manner. But coming online are another 76.5 megahertz for a total of about 100 megahertz of spectrum. So that includes, you know, 50 up at 4940, the 24 and the 700 band, which alone is worth $5 to $10 billion in market terms. So there seems to be, if you put all these three pieces together, 100 megahertz exclusive, all the unlicensed through multipurpose networks and the potential to share with commercial, it's really not a bandwidth issue. It's a policy issue.
May I respond?
Let Mike speak and then respond.
Yes. One thing to keep in mind is the importance of technology to solving this problem. And it's not tomorrow's technology. It's not Buck Rogers. It's stuff that's available here today. In my time at the Department of Commerce, where I worked extensively with the Coast Guard and with the Pentagon and with a wide variety of critical federal missions and making sure that they had the resource they needed to do their job, what was often the solution was the technology that was available. And we have today, certainly not just on the federal systems, we've had a push going forward to do what they call narrowbanding, to move from 24 kilohertz channels to 12 kilohertz channels, to move down eventually to 6 kilohertz channels so that you get more out of less. We have models where that works in today's marketplace. It's in our cellular industry where they have very small channels that accomplish very robust communications capabilities. That same type of thinking needs to be applied to the public safety spectrum, and then the needs that are there are met not just with the existing resource that is in hand, but using the 24 megahertz much more efficiently. So I've just underscored things like trunking, which is a very, very difficult thing to map through, dramatically reduces the need for spectrum. It's not the number one solution. There are other things to look at, like eliminating patching and independent systems, which can also increase the efficiency of how we use spectrum. Just like everything else when we deal with spectrum, and those of you in the room with very familiar faces worked over the years, there are technical components to this that are very real and very important and that do provide us with the path forward.
Chief Warner wanted to respond, and then
can I go? You may want to respond to me, too.
Sure.
The
And actually, because I had a question in what I didn't understand, Chief Horner, is what you do support.
What I do support is the Public Broadband Safety Trust, the Public Safety Broadband Trust, that will give us a shared. Now, here's one of the things I want to make sure it's clear. Everybody keeps trying to say that this additional 30 megahertz is going to be just public safety, and it's not. It's a commercial public-private partnership that goes in similar to Frontline. However, it does in a totally additional. It doesn't affect the 24 megahertz, and it still helps to alleviate some of the spectrum needs. And it creates that paradigm shift. It allows us to have economy of scale of just what you gentlemen are saying, of having enough of us, having enough of the same equipment that becomes a marketplace to get those devices in a way that we can afford them. And I do agree with you that the current paradigm that we're under, if it doesn't change, we're still stuck with proprietary equipment that is very expensive. So we do have some commonality here. I'm not saying you're totally wrong. But the other thing that you just sit up here and you start talking about spectrum and how much spectrum there is that we have for public safety. And, you know, a lot of the spectrum that you're talking about isn't even developed yet. And I'd like to go one step further. I tell you what I'll do. You take all that spectrum and I'll trade it for 700 megahertz and we'll call it an even swap. How about that?
Can I, so I'm clear, because the FCC has, in the Ninth Order, proposed a public safety broadband trust. Frontline, I think, proposes a public safety broadband trust. Is what you're saying you're for, in effect, the totality of the siren call proposal, so with the government-backed guarantees, the private build-out, and so forth? Is that whether or not siren call ends up being the contractor, are you essentially saying that what you're supporting is the siren call proposal?
I would say yes.
Okay. Before saying that, I wanted to make sure I understood that. And Chief, as much as you know, I appreciate that you are the guy going into the buildings, and we're all grateful for that. And you have a tremendous, enthusiasm, doesn't commitment, maybe is a better word, to solving what we all agree is a problem. I would also suggest that there is another element of expertise that comes into play in evaluating the workability of that proposal. That proposal depends upon the ability of a commercially operated entity to create what Morgan O'Brien calls a new commercial cell phone carrier, a new CMRS carrier, which has to go out and be able to sell its services to 30 million commercial subscribers. The entire plan hinges upon whether or not that can be done. And with due respect to you and your colleagues, whose expertise over interoperability issues and public safety communications I don't challenge for a heartbeat, I think that if you would pause for a second and listen to people who have more experience in evaluating the commercial prospects of commercial wireless mobile radio operations, you would do well to pause, because failing the success of that commercial enterprise, you will indeed be stuck.
Well,
you will in fact be stuck without the system having been built out, without the funding to solve the problem, and having spent I don't know how many years digging yourself into a hole, which will in fact look a lot like Next Wave, and you might want to talk with Janice about that, because it wasn't pretty.
I guess with all due respect, the ideology is good in some other senses of what you all said, except the funding's not there. And I guess the last thing that, you know, if I felt that either you didn't have an interest or there wasn't some underlying funding from people that have an ulterior motive that I've had experience with before, I might agree with you a little bit more. Unfortunately, I think that if you look, you'll see a common thread of a funding that goes through a lot of the different work that's been done here or the agencies involved as far as the premise of what's being offered. That's
I really don't. Is this on? Yeah, I really don't have a question. I just have a comment back to Mr. Jones as far as becoming involved with public safety and understanding what those needs are. And really, to all of you, there's a National Public Safety Telecommunications Council group that's been active for the last 10 years They're represented by all the public safety associations in the nation. They meet quarterly. That's where all the planning and coordination for this spectrum is taking place, based on the needs of public safety. And I will venture to guess that no one on this panel either knows about that group or has ever been to one of those meetings. So if you truly want to know what's going on with public safety and what are the needs of public safety, I'd recommend you attend one of those meetings.
I just respond to that real quickly. I certainly do know about the organization, and it's a great forum for public safety to get together and discuss issues. However, I will say this. Good ideas don't just come out of one organization. Good ideas come from a lot of different areas, and that is a large part of what the First Response Coalition is trying to do here. And why we're here today is adding to this conversation, talking about the need for coordination, talking about the need for additional funding, talking about using spectrum more efficiently. Again, it's not just about more spectrum to first responders and bang, the problem's solved. The Department of Homeland Security has said that as well. I'm not saying anything new here, but I don't want these points to get lost in this larger conversation. Funding, collaboration, coordination, all these things are absolutely critical, and I want to drive that point home.
We'll take the next question from Jeff in just a second, but let's try to keep the questions and the comments on the substance of these proposals. Funding is a big issue, but there's definitely more to it than that, and so let's try to keep talking about the proposals and what would work and what wouldn't. Jeff, please.
Okay, well, my name is Jeff Meyer. I am from the New America Foundation. Just a quick question for anyone. Is there a country outside the United States that you guys or someone has looked to as like best practice for a public safety, advanced public safety communication system?
Yeah, I would just simply say that in the discussions we had in my old capacity, it would come up, we would discuss it. It was a lot easier in countries that were smaller because they could more easily deploy systems. One system could serve all much more easily. That didn't have quite the geographical reach of the United States or the complexity. You also have in the U.S., we probably have the most congested spectrum environment in the world because of the strength of our military, because of the strength of our economy that creates more and more pressure on the spectrum. So our problems tend to be more unique, and once we solve them, the rest of the world tends to say, we can learn a lot from that. We'll adopt some of those aspects if they're necessary.
Let me reframe that question. That's a good question. Not whether there are any countries in particular that are best practice, but as I think almost everybody on the panel said, one of the problems is just the many thousands of different public safety entities. Does everybody agree that that is actually one of the problems, and that it may be easier in other countries because they have national, their public safety and first responders are organized under a federal or national government rather than locally? Anybody? I have no opinion.
I don't think so. I don't think that general statement's a safe assumption. I don't think that a national. I personally think that a network developed, implemented by the federal government would ever stand the test of time. I think that it has to be a commercial entity that's in it that has the ability to be profiteering from it, to create and continue to evolve. That's the whole commercial model. I think that if we don't do that, then the system will become obsolete as fast as it's put in place. So I think the answer is no to your question.
I think that would probably be another element of commonality. But
if I could just add to that, there may be something to be said, however, for national leadership that helps to coordinate the many different entities.
There is a national leadership. SAFECOM is in the process of doing that. Unfortunately, through DHS and through the funding, SAFECOM has never had the funding that it needs to do anything of measurable, even though it has done great things with little bits of money. There is a standard coming out. There is many things that are being developed. There are statewide initiatives about interoperability. There's a lot of tools that have been made. There's an interoperability continuum, and it continues.
Okay, wait, so Michael, Mike, Janice, did you want to make a comment also? No? Okay, and then we'll go to another question.
Yeah, I'll just bring up one, another a piece of this puzzle that stems from the fractured nature is in the paper that we published as follows, that's out on the table by Professor John Pia at CMU. He mentions, for example, that the federal government is going to spend between $3 and $20 billion to build this integrated wireless network, IWN, just for 3% of first responders, just for the federal guys. And so why isn't that money being used to build the network that would be for all first responders? Now, I can't say I know for sure that the spectrum they plan to use, the federal spectrum, would be the right spectrum or enough spectrum to service, you know, to have an interoperable level across, interoperable network across the different levels of government. But certainly, we ought to be pooling the resources because on the flip side, one of the things that drives the cost through the roof for public safety deployment is that they're using, and as mentioned several times today, they're mentioning using these proprietary devices. When in fact there ought to, with standardization, you could have much greater economies of scale.
You'll have no argument for me on that point.
Michael and Jeff.
Yeah, I would just say that, Michael, I think Janice and I would both agree. We're very thankful you can direct that question to John Neuer now. what I would say is we've seen an example of this problem. Fragmentation and market, very small market participants, we know what that looks like. It's called the wireless industry the way it was 10 years ago. When you have 50,000, I think the number was 53,000 and change, total licenses that covered the United States for six different carriers nationwide, there was a very fragmented buying pattern, and no individual carrier had the ability to dictate terms on handsets to the manufacturers to say, this is what we wanted, and this is what we're ready to pay. When I worked at a wireless carrier, we would order phones 25,000, 50,000, 100,000 at a time, and when you're doing that, the bargaining power between the two very much favors the manufacturer. If you have a consolidated buying position, much like you see with the larger carriers today where we've had consolidation, you see the carriers dictating terms to the manufacturers about what they expect in a device. Happens for everybody except for Apple. They get to make their own choices. But everyone else, now there's very careful consideration given to solving specific customer concerns as seen through the carrier. Public safety is that individual here. If you could move away from that fragmented model and have centralized buying and have this type of activity, it would be a much more powerful force in the marketplace, and you'd see faster adoption of cheaper devices.
And thus the great reason for a public safety broadband trust.
Well, a couple things. One is, I mean, do we have a failure here? We have a failure here, I think, of epic proportions. Now, the playing ground has changed a little bit in the sense that the balance has shifted over time from in the direction of needing the capability to have interoperability across agencies and across geographic regions, across levels of government, across geographic areas of government. So, but do we have anything like the level of coordination we need today? The answer is no. I was asked this question. I was speaking to the National Association of Counties telecommunications group last weekend, and I was asked sort of a question like this, which is, don't we really need to be able to take advantage of the commercial marketplace? And the answer, I come back to what Mike said, is within an environment in which you have standard setting, yes, you can take advantage of economies of scale in the commercial marketplace. But what we don't have today is we don't have the standard setting exercise. So it is still not only possible but typical today for different entities to go out and purchase on their own, to build infrastructure on their own, and to come up with operating rules on their own, and you end up with not having interoperability. Clearly, you need much stronger standard setting, and that is something the FCC can do with or without a public safety broadband trust. The one kind of inconsistency in terms of the public safety broadband trust, that the entity that would operate the siren call plan, in fact, is a board of directors, which would be comprised of government agencies. And so the profiteering that Chief Warner referenced and admires, either would or wouldn't happen, but in theory, as Siren Call explains, it wouldn't happen. Siren Call or whoever operated this commercial network would be doing so purely as a contractor on behalf of a commercial mobile operator that would have as its board of directors dozen or so government agencies, and as its financial backer, venture capitalist, the U.S. taxpayer. So, whether or not that satisfies, I don't think there's any disagreement about the need for a much stronger coordinating body in a standard setting role, but at least in the siren call structure, it's not a standard setting role, it's an operating role. And I, whatever the words profiteering or simply market-based mechanisms, I don't think you would get the kind of response to incentives that you'd like to have out of that kind of board of directors.
You had a question.
Hi, I'm Jerry Brito from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. My question is, from what I understand, the four plans all would have one single national network. And Mr. Calabrese brought up the specter of an unregulated monopoly. I can see how there would be competition on the commercial side of the venture, but what would keep innovation and prices in check on the public safety side? Just a question for any of you.
Well, I can comment in part. I mean, certainly on the government side, where the 12 megahertz has been allocated, prices would be in check and fully subject to the control of the broadband trust, you know, however it's constituted and however, you know, the corporate structure is defined. Similarly, that would be subject to negotiation on the commercial side. In terms of an innovation picture, I think, you know, we've heard papers about various local and regional first responder bodies who are, you know, innovating magnificently. And one of the reasons that we believe that an open access vision holds true both on the public safety and on the general networking side of our proposal is that it in fact enables a multiplicity of approaches to be part of one national integrated network. Now, you know, you can always sort of, it's an interesting question you raise. It's a very good question. At the end of the day, it appears as though, you know, all of these proposals are saying one of the key solutions to the nationwide interoperability dilemma is to ensure that at least the, you know, the sort of trunk and spokes of the network, the broad integrating piece would be in some way a national network.
And if I can add to that, the other thing that it does is it creates an economy of scale for public safety. That means devices that would work on this new network would also work with all the other technologies and access to things that you normally wouldn't be able to do. You'd, in other words, have to have a device-specific functioning on your proprietary system today as opposed to having one that can do both. And then if you have the spectrum that's adjacent to each other, it means that the functionality of our mission-critical radios might be developed in a different way such that it can have access to mission-critical systems and the non-mission-critical systems. So you have a paradigm that allows you to do that.
Mike? Yeah, just for clarification, Larry's in my proposal does not speak to a single network that would be developed. I think if you look at it more like an electric grid is probably the best way to look at it, is those are very distinct pieces. They all do interconnect, and you can take devices from one part of the grid, plug it into the walls on the other side of the country, it still works. Same thing for the equipment that works to hand off power between the two different grids that are around the country. That leaves much more flexibility in the hands of regions to develop their own particular needs and not have it be, you know, one size fits all from the top.
One final comment from the, Michael, and then one last question was over here.
The issue you raised, it's probably even more difficult than I suggested, just because also public safety's needs may change over time. And yet, you know, then, you know, they have this, whether it's on a regional or national basis, they have this single network provider. So there's a difficult trade-off between, on the one hand, there would be this inclination to have a very long license period so that, you know, supposedly they could recoup their infrastructure cost. On the other hand, you really need the hammer over their head, potentially, of being able to take the license, of not renewing the license. And you'd have to make sure that the license conditions include forfeiting infrastructure, you know, on some, you know, arbitrated rate if they lost the license, you know, at any time. And the public safety trust ought to always be able to yank that. And then there's also the other tough issue is the build-out requirement. I haven't really seen that any of these proposals, you know, have what looks like, you know, an ideal build-out, because there's an inherent conflict of interest. The commercial operator will want to go to the most populated, you know, areas first, I would think, and the rural areas are going to be, you know, it's going to be a tough initial negotiation to get to those places.
Well, you know, I would like to make one observation on the build-out. And Frontline, in talking about its commercial business, is talking about a relatively small adjunct, you know, 10 megahertz in total. This will, our proposal would never be a broadband, you know, it could never be a Verizon, AT&T, T-Mobile competitor. It does not have the capacity to be a nationwide, ubiquitous, you know, everybody comes mega network. This is a coverage network, much more than a capacity network. And I think that defines the story somewhat differently. And if you're in the business of holding yourself out as a coverage provider, as a roaming provider, an access provider to devices, as well as the public service, public safety network of networks, you will have very different incentives. And in fact, there would very likely be a market for near ubiquity.
Well, let's take one last question before we're ejected from the room.
Thank you. I'm Ed Woods, legislative director for the Maryland Fire Chiefs. I have more of an observation than a question. I've had a lot of questions answered already, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and I appreciate the frankness of some of the presentations. The best thing that can be said about me is I'd last about 30 seconds in the State Department. I tell it like it is. I have to. People's lives depend on it some days. And this is a mess. And I'm unhappy. And the 40,000 people in the Maryland Fire Service that I represent are unhappy. We want something done. We dealt with the consensus plan a few years ago. I think there's probably a few people in this room that remember that battle. The consensus plan finally worked out largely. Or it's working out, or will be. It's a process. The same thing happened then. I see it happening again today. Everybody's tiptoed around it, and nobody spoke up. Problem is, corporations like Motorola and Verizon are putting their bottom line ahead of the lives of my firefighters, and I don't like it. And I want that word to get back to them. I want them to butt out. It's none of their damn business what public safety's doing. They need to worry about their bottom line on their cell phone bills. They need to worry about their wire phones. They need to get the heck out of public safety's business and leave us alone. Let's build a system. If somebody come up with a better proposal in siren calls, I'll buy it. So far, nobody has.
Last comment.
Thank you.
From the panel. Let's start this time in reverse alphabetical.
I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I'd like to encourage that any of you that have other think tanks that have these kind of discussions, please make sure you have somebody from public safety at the table. You know, it's kind of sad when you look back and you see these panels taking place and there's not one of us here in uniform that does the job to keep a balance on the discussion that takes place. And I appreciate all the discussions from all the panelists here. And I know that at the end of the day, everybody's working toward trying to accomplish a similar goal. But thank you for letting me be here today, Scott.
Same message. Thank you for being here. I respect the point of view of my fellow panelists and look forward to working with you in the future. Thanks.
Yeah, again, thanks so much. It was a real honor and a pleasure to be here today. I have to take this opportunity to plug the First Response Coalition's efforts to establish the National First Responder Appreciation Day. So if you care to visit the website at firstresponsecoalition.org and sign that, that'd be much appreciated. And another point, this is about the first responders at the end of the day, and I just wanted to restate a quote that we used in our report, which, again, is available on the table and on our website. It's Mark Palance, who is the radio system administrator for the Nevada State Radio System. And he says, you know, one of the key aspects at talking about their system is that everybody is on the system, understands how it works, its capabilities, and they strive to improve it. First-line responders are the ones that should have a say into what goes into the systems, not politicians at the other end of the spectrum. Thanks.
I'll add to the chorus of thank yous and just say that we have the technology, we have the spectrum, and the funding is coming online to solve this problem now, and that we need leadership to solve it. Thank you. Almost forgot.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, PFF. So I don't think that we have the solution, but I think that the pieces of the solution for the first time in a long time have come together. And, you know, I do give Siren Call credit for bringing a couple of important ideas to the table. The notion of a public safety broadband trust in some way, shape, or form originated, at least in the recent debate in April, with the Siren Call proposal, has now been incorporated in the Ninth Order. The concept of spectrum sharing has and preemptibility of adjacent spectrum, those ideas have been advanced further by the frontline proposal. That is also a contribution to the debate. Certainly people are now focused on this, and thank goodness, because for those of you who are unhappy, angry, upset at where things stand today, I think we all ought to share that. This 24 megahertz of spectrum, as somebody mentioned, was first designated for public safety use 10 years ago. You know, how many crises and failures do we need to have before people realize this is an issue that needs to get solved? So there is a lot coming up now in the next couple of months. I think maybe the fire has been lit. And the one thing I'd say is, all of us are frustrated with where things stand, and the one thing that I would suggest is that if people would focus a little bit less on motives and a little bit less on history and a little bit more on finding a solution, I kind of think there is one there to be found now with good faith on all parts. So I hope we'll do that.
Michael? Yeah, I just want to thank PFF for hosting this debate, which is critically important, very timely. I think one thing it should be pointed out that, you know, it seems that there really was there's consensus about public safety needing more access to the airwaves. I think my point is this can be done in a variety of ways, because we certainly want to make sure they have all of the communications capacity and security that they need. I should clarify, I mean, New America, my program, is not supported by anyone with any stake in this at all. Although, I did very much take Chief Werner's point about, since I run a think tank program, of including the folks in uniform in these discussions, very important, and I'm glad the PFF did that. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to thank all of the panelists for coming today. It was really I never like panels where everyone agrees with each other. We certainly did not have that problem today. Although I actually think that on the substance, people work closer together than I thought. I'm sort of looking forward to reflecting on what.
Were we in the same meeting?
I think so. Well, it was different over down on this end. But I appreciate everyone coming, and I hope you'll join me in thanking the panelists for a really stimulating discussion.